The gulf between human medicine and veterinary medicine is large, and it turns out that a great deal of life-saving information may have been lost in that gap. Today, we'll fill in some of the pieces. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, authors of the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. We'll find out what cardiologists, oncologists, and even psychiatrists can learn from the people who care for non-human animals. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout. Her latest novel is The Burgess Boys. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout about her latest novel, The Burgess Boys. But first, humans are members of the animal kingdom. But we tend to focus on ourselves as a species apart, different in so many ways. In the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health, Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers explore some of what we can learn by embracing our similarities with our fellow animals. The book was just released in paperback today, and the co-authors are at Iowa State University. They'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks so much for having us. It's such a pleasure.
And Dr. Natterson-Horowitz, this book begins with an experience that you had at the Los Angeles Zoo. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you experienced that day that you write about at the beginning of the book.
Yes, well, I have been a cardiologist at UCLA Medical Center for many years and, you know, taking care of what cardiologists take care of, heart attacks and heart failure and all those kinds of problems. And then I had this opportunity to become a member of the medical advisory board of our local zoo. And so from time to time, the veterinarians at the zoo would call and ask if I'd come to the zoo and help them with some of their imaging needs. I do ultrasound of the heart. That's my specialty within human cardiology. And although the veterinarians there are highly skilled and they take care of a vast array of problems in their patients, from time to time, they, you know, really reach into the human medical community for some help. So I got to go to the zoo. And while I was at the zoo, I would begin listening to veterinarians on rounds. And I would hear them talking about breast cancer in a lion and congestive heart failure in a kangaroo and obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, in a wolf. And this was just so surprising to me because I had, in all my years of practicing human medicine, I had just never given much thought to this idea that the diseases that I had taken care of in human patients also happened in this wide range of animals. And that's how it got started.
Well, and tell us about, you were caring for an emperor tamarin, a tiny primate, who was having a problem with its heart. And you really had an epiphany that day. That happened in 2005. I think the little tamarin was called Spitzbuben.
Spitzbuben, yes. And she was beautiful. Yeah, there was a situation at the zoo where some of the tamarin, by the way, tamarin are these really small, adorable little Central and South American monkeys. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest. And some of the tamarin had developed congestive heart failure. So one of the things that they wanted me to do was to do ultrasounds on the tamarin's heart to see whether we could predict which animals were going to get sick and whether we could intervene with the same kinds of medications we would give to human patients. So I came to the zoo this day, and there was Spitzbuben, and she was being, when I got there, they were giving her some medicine to make her sleepy to get her ready for the procedure. They had her in a little box with a plexiglass side, and I could see her and she could see me, and she was so beautiful and adorable. And so as she was getting sedated, I moved closer toward her, and I crouched down to get really close to her and look at her deeply into her eyes. This is what I would do with a human patient or a child, let's say, that I was trying to create a trust bond with. So I said, "Oh, Spitzbuben, you know, you're so cute. It's going to be okay." And just as I was saying that, the head veterinarian put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Please stop making eye contact like that. You're scaring her. You're going to give her capture myopathy.
Capture myopathy. And yes. that was something you had never heard of. I've never heard of.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, myopathy, of course, I've heard of myopathy as a disease of the muscle, and there's lots of myopathies in human medicine. But capture myopathy, definitely I'd never heard of it. But I did as I was told. I backed away. I was intrigued, and as soon as I got home, I Googled capture myopathy. And I learned that animals from shorebirds to hoofed animals to rabbits, lots and lots of animals, when they are very, very scared, typically when they're being chased by a predator, when they're being restrained, when they fear that death is imminent, their bodies are flooded with adrenaline, which can poison their muscles, sometimes poison their heart muscle, and they can sometimes die. So it was you know, interesting to learn about this, but what clicked in that moment was how similar capture myopathy sounded to this human diagnosis, which had been recently characterized around the year 2000, was describing that human patients, when they were either very scared, when they had gone through something very traumatic, being left at the altar, losing their life savings with the roll of the dice, something really traumatic, that they too could be either scared to death or traumatized to death, that there's this acute form of heart failure that could happen. So as I put capture myopathy next to this human form of the broken heart syndrome, as it's sometimes called, I realized that these two disorders were, if not first cousins, possibly really the same disorder. But what was really interesting wasn't the similarity. It was the gulf and the gap, because while veterinarians had been not only describing capture myopathy for decades, they were preventing it and treating it, in the human literature, it was just described, you know, about a few years before I had encountered the diagnosis. And I thought, my goodness, this is fascinating. And if this is happening to me as a cardiologist, what other syndromes and knowledge do veterinarians know about that we humans don't? And that's one of the ways this started.
So it wasn't just that you started to realize that animals could suffer, many other animals could suffer from the same kinds of problems that humans could suffer from, but that there may be areas of veterinary medicine that could give us incredible insight into human medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And Catherine and I really, that was the approach of the book. We said, well, yes, we are animals. We humans are animals. And what would happen if we looked at important human medical problems, things like obesity and, you know, adolescence, let's say, eating disorders, self-injury, cancer, congestive heart failure? What if we looked at those problems through the lens of veterinary medicine? What would a veterinarian do for a human animal with that same problem? And what we learned was that there's extensive knowledge that veterinarians have, that animal experts have, that could be very effective in taking care of human patients, not only with physical problems, but also with mental illnesses that human medicine doesn't have access to because, frankly, we never talk to veterinarians or we rarely talk to veterinarians.
And this book is told as your story, Dr. Nadasen Horowitz, but this was a complete collaboration between the two of you. And Catherine, I wonder, you're a journalist. When you were brought into this project, what was your reaction to this idea that we could learn so much from veterinary medicine about human medicine?
Yeah, well, I was really just surprised at how much I didn't know, even as a patient, a parent, as someone who considers herself relatively in touch with the world. I encountered many different diseases and conditions in animals that I had never even really thought of as having parallels on the human side, and vice versa. And so Barbara and I met and we worked together for about a year and realized that we didn't have a word to describe this overlap, and so we decided to come up with zubiquity. And we took the Greek word for animal, which is zo, and combined it with Latin for everywhere to come up with zubiquity.
In starting to do this research, you had to cross a lot of barriers that had been put up for many, many years, for really important reasons. I mean, one of those is that we're taught in scientific worlds, we're taught not to anthropomorphize animals. We're taught not to project human emotions or human feelings, thoughts onto these animals. And that was something that you almost felt like was leading us down the wrong path in some ways.
Yeah, well, as the research kept rolling in, as we got deeper and deeper into it, we realized that rather than suffering from anthropomorphizing, the way that we look at our shared diseases and health as members of the same planet really are similar enough that we run more risk of what we call under-ubiquitizing rather than anthropomorphizing. Just that we tend to, as humans, look at that small 1% difference that we have from other creatures instead of looking at the vast, vast overlap.
One of the things that was we kept asking ourselves as we were noticing these comparisons, I mean, I'll give you an example. When we started talking about obesity, we learned a lot about how animals get fat, in our homes, our companion animals, and how they sometimes get fat in the wild. And we asked ourselves, well, you know, is this really relevant to a human patient with a weight problem? What are the connections? And so we looked at that, you know, that question, how can we make these connections? And we looked at it from a genetic perspective. Well, we now know that that our genome is highly conserved. The mammalian genome is highly conserved. Certainly, if you look at great apes like chimpanzees and gorillas and other great apes, we share the vast majority of genetics with them. And frankly, with most other mammals, and with most other tetrapods as well, we are much more related than we are unrelated. And if you look at the nervous system, if you look at the digestive system, certainly if you look at the cardiovascular system, they are highly conserved. Not identical, of course, there are species differences, but it's a much more scientifically credible supposition that we look for comparisons than that we exclusively focus on difference.
Yeah, and then Barbara and I just really thought that it's time that we start thinking of the human patient as the human-animal patient and just ask, where are these comparisons relevant?
And beyond the physiological similarities, though, you did also, you already mentioned OCD, you delved into the psychiatric illnesses that we see in the rest of the animal kingdom as well.
This was something that was extra interesting to me, was that you're right, the physiology, it's not too hard to understand that we share blood and bones and hearts, and we have a lot of crossovers with our bodies that we share with animals. But the idea that something that a psychiatrist might call a mental disorder could be found in another animal was extra interesting.
Let's take a short break, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. I'm talking with Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. They are the co-authors of the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. And the book just came out in paperback. They'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University at 7 o'clock in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout. But right now, I'm talking with the co-authors of a book called Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. With me are Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. And this book came out of an experience that Dr. Natterson-Horowitz had as a cardiologist, but also as a consultant at the Los Angeles Zoo, and an understanding that she had that maybe we could learn a great deal from what we see disease-wise in the animal kingdom and what from what veterinarians know and what we can learn about human health. And just before the break, we were talking about how you not only looked at how the human animal and other animals are similar in physiological ways, but also in psychiatric ways. And what were some of the things that you found as you started to look into psychiatric similarities?
We learned about disorders ranging from the canine cognitive dysfunction, which is a corollary to Alzheimer's disease, canine compulsive disorder, which is a corollary to obsessive compulsive disease in humans. We even learned about something called the berserk llama syndrome and something called full rejection syndrome, which is, I think, a correlate to the severe form of postpartum depression that's seen in women.
And in full, you're talking about horses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, occasionally a mare, very often a first-time mother mare, will reject the foal. There are certain breeds of horses in whom it's seen more commonly, so there's a genetic basis to it, but she may not want to feed the foal. She may not want to be near the foal. In some rare instances, she may actually attack the foal. The foal may become, you know, endangered. And it seems highly likely there are some conserved, some shared endocrine or neuroendocrine mechanism between this, you know, potentially very dramatic and potentially life-threatening situation in horses and what we see in women who occasionally develop a very severe form of postpartum depression and psychosis.
That is fascinating. You explored why people pass out, and that's such an interesting exploration because the idea of fainting seems to make us incredibly vulnerable. And as you point out in the book, it seems like something that would have been weeded out through evolution because it seems like something that would have led fainters to not make it. But then you looked at other members of the animal kingdom and you found a lot of benefits to fainting.
Right. Yeah. Fainting is one of these problems that you see a lot of as a cardiologist. People think cardiologists take care of just the big dramatic stuff, but we see a lot of fainting patients. And actually, one of the stories that we tell in the book is actually when I took my then 12-year-old daughter to get her ears pierced. And, I mean, she had been begging me to get her ears pierced for a long time. And there we were I took her to a friend who's a physician to have him do it. And she was sitting there, and as the ear piercing gun got closer and closer to her ear, she said, "Mom, I don't feel well." And next thing I knew, she was slumped over. She had fainted. So the question is, well, why would this happen? I mean, wouldn't you think that evolution would have weeded out the fainters in favor of the fighters and the fleers? And Catherine and I learned that animals from canaries to lapdogs to deer, they, when they are in danger, sometimes they mount a racing heart and the fight-flight response. But other times, their hearts respond to the threat by slowing and profoundly slowing. And it would seem that the reason this happens, by the way, it's seen not only in mammals, it's seen in reptiles, it's even seen in fish. And it seems likely that this slowing is a form of anti-predation protection, that it's a way that the animal can protect themselves. Because by slowing the heart rate, it keeps the animal, particularly the young animal, very still. If it's a fish who's slowing its heart rate, and if the predator is tracking the electrical impulses that come off of each heartbeat, which many sharks and other predatory underwater animals do, a very slowed heart rate can protect the fish from, you know, becoming a meal. So it really is a way of understanding why we see this seemingly paradoxical response to stress. You know, human patients faint for lots of different reasons, but there are people who faint when they get their blood drawn. They may faint when they have a long bone fracture. I have to say, when I was looking at the video of Kevin Ware in that basketball game last week, I had what we call a vagal response. I felt my heart rate changing a little bit. So intense emotion can activate this fainting reflex. It's called the vasovagal reflex. And what Catherine and I learned is that there is this species-spanning response of a slowed heart rate that probably served and continues to serve a protective benefit for our animal ancestors.
And for humans as well. And that's probably what you were going to launch into, Catherine.
Yes, I was just going to say what we realized is that our typical kind of two-part idea of fight or flight as solutions to any problem really needs to be updated. It's not fight or flight. There's a third option, and that's faint. And to me, that you know, it's interesting to think about that in a physical situation, but also if you were to carry that out to how we react to other kinds of stressors that may stand in for a predator in our modern lives, that we don't just have to fight it or flee it. We can also freeze. We can think about it. We can maybe stay still for a moment, and that can be equally as protective or an equally valid response. That was kind of an interesting way of taking it from the physical more into the philosophical.
Absolutely. Well, and the example that you used of infants in utero in Baghdad, when the city was under siege, there was an observation that these women who were in labor, that when the bombs started falling, the Scud missiles, which are so loud, that the babies that were about to be delivered, their heart rates dropped dramatically. So you theorize that perhaps children of our species use this same response to be safe.
Yeah, what veterinarians call fear or alarm bradycardia. Bradycardia is the medical term for a slowed heart. This is seen more prominently in juvenile members of species. And the theory is that, a juvenile is less equipped to mount a fight or an effective flight. And so the part of the autonomic nervous system that might protect them by slowing the heart would take over. And actually what you're describing is a story we told in the book. We learned that this reflex, this slowing of the heart in response to loud noise or fear, presumably it's related, occurs in even human infants and in utero. It was during the first week of the first Persian Gulf War, and there was a maternity ward in Tel Aviv, actually. Scud missiles were being sent into Israel during that first week. And as the Scuds were launched, there were sirens that would go off both outside and through televisions and radios. So these women were in labor on a maternity ward. They had the monitors, hooked up so that the fetal heart rate was being tracked. And as the sirens went off, all of the women on the maternity ward, the babies, their heart rates plummeted from like 140 to 150 to like between 30 and 40 beats per minute. So these soon-to-be infants, these not yet born babies, already had this. They had this shared fear bradycardic response.
Before we run out of time, there's so much we could talk about. We could talk all day. I want to talk about cancer because you wrote some fascinating things about cancer. Among some of those fascinating things, you found that evidence had been discovered that dinosaurs actually had cancer, which was very interesting. But I think the most interesting thing that you wrote about is how we can learn a great deal from the study of cancer in dogs. Because there are so many dogs get cancer, but also because they live in our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about some of the research being done on dogs and cancer right now.
Well, first of all, we should make really clear that we're talking about pet dogs with cancer that are being treated by veterinary oncologists who are helping these dogs live longer and healthier and happier lives. These are not lab animals. And you're right, there are many similarities between human cancer and dog cancer. And what's really important is we do share environments with them. We share our homes, we feed them, we often have similar activity levels to our own pets, and they make really interesting models for looking at human cancer.
And there was a new cancer treatment that was tried out on dogs. I'd love for one of you to tell us about this experiment. It was with a veterinarian, Philip Bergman, I believe. And he tried out a new cancer treatment on dogs that included injecting human DNA into them?
That's right. We met him. His name is Philip Bergman, and he's a veterinary oncologist in the New York area. He was at dinner one night with a group of cancer experts from Memorial Sloan Kettering. They were all human cancer experts, and one of them turned to him and said, "Do dogs get melanoma?" And Phil Bergman happens to be a world leader in melanoma in dogs. And so the two of them partnered together to investigate melanoma in humans and dogs, and they came up with, it's called a vaccine, but it's a treatment for dog melanoma that uses the body's own immune system to attack the cancer in itself. And it's now being prescribed for dog cancer, and is showing promise for human treatment as well.
And as you mentioned, these are not lab animals. So in many ways, this is an experiment that is being conducted on pets that could have profound impacts on human medicine, but is not being conducted in a lab, not being conducted in any way that people might construe as inhumane.
No, the opposite. Exactly. These are clinical trials, really, for pets who are sick, who are looking at, unfortunately, a disease that could end their life. And when Dr. Bergman set up this trial, I mean, he was recruiting pet dogs from owners who were desperate to save their animals. There was a Siberian Husky and a Bichon and a German Shepherd and Cocker Spaniels, and people were flying in from all over the world for this opportunity to be part of a clinical trial to potentially save the life of their beloved pet. So the reason that this is what we call translational, which is the word for research that can come back over to the human side, is that the diseases are very similar. Canine melanoma is very similar to melanoma in human beings. And because what we learn then from the treatment of these animals becomes relevant to taking care of human patients. There are other forms of cancer also that are very similar in dogs and humans, and including a form of bone cancer that affects teenagers and also affects many, many large breed dogs. So this work has the potential to not only save the lives of pets, but also to save the lives of human beings who have the same problem.
In the closing chapter of the book, you wrote about West Nile virus that showed up first in New York City, in the United States, that is, in New York City in the year 1999. There were all kinds of dead crows being discovered. And as a researcher was trying to figure out what was happening, there were many people trying to figure out what was happening, but there was also this disease that started showing up in older humans. A sample from the crows or from other birds was sent to a lab at Iowa State University, the USDA lab in Iowa, and that's where this virus was finally isolated. But in a report on that discovery, there was a sidebar from the CDC, I think, that said the veterinary community should not be overlooked. So here was an example of the veterinary community working together with human medicine and discovering what was going on a lot faster than either one really could have done alone.
Yes, although in that particular story, what happened was the veterinarian was the one who was suspicious and was trying to raise the alarm, and the human side, for a number of reasons, some of which are cultural, was ignoring her. They weren't giving her the chance to say, this is a disease we need to be looking at. So once she finally got through, the CDC changed what the diagnosis was. They said it was West Nile. It was the debut of West Nile in North America. And you're right, then they did issue this thing that we need to work more closely with veterinarians. And there is a group called, a movement called One Health, which is trying to bring humans and animals and the doctors who treat them together to look at infectious diseases, and that has gained momentum in the last few years.
Well, one of the things that Tracy McNamara, who's the veterinary pathologist who we featured in this chapter, one of the things she encountered was a kind of condescension that, unfortunately, some of the veterinarians that we interviewed, described feeling coming from the human medical community. There are a number of barriers that have existed that have led to this a real gulf between human and veterinary medicine, and some of the blame lies really squarely within my own profession, a certain kind of snobbery, and also a lack of awareness of just how overlapping the diseases of animals and humans are. So we tried to sort of make the point in that chapter that condescension has to be a thing of the past, that we really need to work in an interdisciplinary way.
This book is fascinating, and I learned so much from reading it about all of these different diseases and myself and how things appear in the animal world. But I wonder what the two of you are really hoping will come out of this book. I mean, it's a fascinating read, it's an enlightening read, but what do you hope people will really take away from it, and where do you want this to go?
So I think there are, it's a great question, and there are a couple of ways to answer that. As a physician, I'm interested in two takeaways. The first is how this can help patients in the short term, and then in the longer run, can this lead to a new way of thinking that can generate better hypotheses that lead to investigation that leads to, to cures, to treatment. There are, we cover in our book, we look at self-injury, we look at addiction, we look at obesity, we look at eating disorders, and these conditions are highly stigmatized in human beings who have them. Unfortunately, a lot of patients who have mental illness don't get the help that they need because of stigma. We think that knowing that addiction, for example, or self-injury, that these things happen in lots of animals other than human beings, can help people reframe the problem, potentially destigmatize it, and offer an expanded perspective on them. But beyond that, this comparative method, this idea that veterinarians are taught this way from the first week of veterinary school, you know, when they learn about cardiology, they learn about a four-chambered heart in a mammal and a three-chambered heart in a reptile and a two-chambered heart in a fish and how the electrical system works in these different compositions. As a physician, we're simply taught about one species. The comparative method really expands how you think about any medical problem. And I think bringing this perspective back into human medicine will help physicians think about disease and potential therapies in an expanded way.
And I think for all the rest of us, patients and parents and animal lovers, it's just really a connecting message that the world is getting smaller and smaller because of jet travel and internet connectivity, and we really all live on the same planet, sharing the same spaces, and our health is interconnected too. And if we can remember that, it'll help us think of treatments and cures for some of these diseases and also ways of living together.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, they are the co-authors of the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. They'll be speaking at the Great Hall of the Memorial Union in Ames, Iowa, at Iowa State University, this evening at 7 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In her latest novel, Pulitzer Prize winner Elizabeth Strout once again takes readers to a familiar landscape, a small town in her home state of Maine. But for the first time, she also takes us to the city she's called home for most of her adult life, New York City. The Burgess Boys is about two brothers and a sister who share a tragic past and a complicated present, but the book is also about the tension between the small town, the big city, and the greater world, a tension that resonates here in Iowa as well. Elizabeth Strout is reading at Prairie Lights in Iowa City tonight at 7 o'clock. She's also with me now. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And
It's my pleasure.
It's so interesting to talk about what this book is about, because when you share the plot outline about the Burgess Boys, these brothers and their sister, it sounds like such an incredibly dramatic story. But the novel is not just about that, but in all these little places and little details and quiet moments in between. And as you're
exactly
talking to people about this book, do you find that we get caught up in that big dramatic story perhaps a little too much?
Yes. Well, I think it's hard to try and tell what a book is about because a book is really about the experience that you have reading it. You know, it's really about your relationship with the voice that rises off the page or however the story comes to you. I mean, that's really what happens when you read a book. And so it's very difficult to talk about it without having that actual experience right in front of you.
Well, in the beginning of the book, you have a prologue where you introduce the reader to some of these big dramatic things that set the stage for the action that is to come
right
in the book. In the prologue, you do something that's unusual. In that prologue, you introduce a character who is sort of the omniscient narrator for the entire book.
That's right. That's right. And I've never written a prologue before. And that was, I was surprised that I did that. And I just kind of played around with it a little bit later on in the process of writing the book, and then I thought, well, I'll keep it around and see if it works. And then I realized, no, I do need this, and I want this, and I enjoyed the idea of just a few pages of the prologue. It's a first person narrator who's talking, who lives in New York City, who talks frequently on the phone or sometimes in Maine with her mother who lives in Maine about their old hometown, because that's what I think people do, especially as they get older. And in this case, both women at the time that they're talking are widowed. And so they just chat and reminisce, and they're reminiscing about the Burgess Boys. And it just sort of tickled me. I thought, well, yeah, there, I'm going to do it that way.
Can you read a little bit from the prologue for us?
I will read just the very last page of the prologue, which, again, the prologue's not long, but so you've got this mother and daughter talking. And so it began, like a cat's cradle connecting my mother to me and me to Shirley Falls. Bits of gossip and news and memories about the lives of the Burgess kids supported us. We reported and repeated. I told my mother again about the time I had come across Helen Burgess, Jim's wife, when they lived, as I once did, in the neighborhood of Park Slope in Brooklyn. My husband and I one night found ourselves dining near Helen and a friend in Park Slope Cafe. We stopped near Helen's table as we were leaving. I'd had some wine, I suppose that's why I stopped, and I said to her that I'd come from the same town Jim had grown up in. Something happened to Helen's face that stayed with me. A look of quick fear seemed to pass over it. She asked my name, and I told her, and she said Jim had never mentioned me. No, I was younger, I said. And then she arranged her cloth napkin with a little shake and said, I haven't been up there in years. Nice to meet you both. Bye-bye. My mother thought that Helen could have been friendlier that night. She came from money, remember, my mother said. She thinks she's better than someone from Maine. This sort of remark was when I had learned to let go. I no longer bothered myself with the defensiveness of my mother and her mane. But after Susan Burgess's son did what he did, after the story about him had been in the newspapers, even in the New York Times and on television too, I said on the phone to my mother, I think I'm going to write the story of the Burgess kids. It's a good one, she agreed. People will say it's not nice to write about people I know. My mother was tired that night. She yawned. Well, you don't know them, she said. Nobody ever knows anyone.
Elizabeth Strout reading from the prologue of her new novel, The Burgess Boys. And since we have teased this idea a little bit about these dramatic happenings that set the scene for the novel, the children, the Burgess boys, they're not children anymore. They're adults in this book. But when they were kids, these
exactly.
brothers and their sister were involved in an accident that killed their father.
That's right. And that's known at the very beginning, that this is part of their history and part of what the mother and daughter in the prologue are chatting about.
Because in a small town, an incident like that never gets forgotten.
Exactly. It never gets forgotten. And yet, you know, and the town just grows up around it, and that's that. But something else that was interesting to me about that sort of notion is I'm always interested in place, you know, time and place. And at that time of the accident, which would have been probably the late 50s or mid-50s, the narrator and her mother can talk about it. But as you discover, as you read through the book, the Burgess kids who actually experienced it, they never talk about it. And that is not unusual, or it was not unusual for the culture of Maine. You know, we're not real talkers in Maine, and it's not like a culture where people would necessarily just hash the whole thing over for the next 30 years. It's not like that. So this is an incident that occurred and has never really been discussed.
And then in the course of the novel, another incident occurs, and that's the sister, her son, desecrates a mosque. In Shirley Falls, Maine, there has been this influx of immigrants, refugees really, coming from Somalia, and he throws a frozen pig head into the mosque. And that's the story that really puts things in motion, because now the family has to work together to deal with that incident. What inspired you to include something so dramatic and so really strange? Was there an actual real-life incident that inspired
that? There was a real-life incident, and it's interesting because I had very much the Burgess boys going, and they had a sister. And so I was very involved in writing about the brothers, you know, who had run as adults to New York City to reinvent themselves, as people do, particularly in this country. We can go someplace else and, you know, start again. And so I was very interested in that and their relationship and the fact that they left their sister behind. And then in real life, this incident did occur in Lewiston, Maine, and I found it very compelling because, you know, I do love Maine. I have a great deal of ambivalence about the state, but I'm very concerned about things that happen in Maine, and that this should occur was very troubling to me as a citizen, as a person, as it was to many people in the town. But as a novelist, I began to realize that I could make the character, the perpetrator of this act, somebody different from the person who really did commit the act. I could, you know, create. That's what's so fun about being a novelist, is that I could suspend judgment and look at it and think, okay, let's go into this character and realize that he's terribly lonely, he's very isolated, and honestly, he doesn't really even get what he did fully.
The tension that's created in Shirley Falls in Maine by the Somalis who are taking refuge there and becoming part of the community. Was that something that you studied, watching immigrant populations come in to create a realistic picture?
Yes. Once I realized that this was something that was going to be a part of this book, then I realized, okay, this is a very big deal and I have to know absolutely everything I can possibly know. And so I started by reading a history of the country of Somalia, a history of their civil war, you know, various civil wars, their dictatorships. I read tremendous amounts about the camps in Kenya that many citizens had gone to. I read about how it is that some people are allowed into the country, the different entrance points into the country, what it's like for them, and then eventually did speak with some Somali immigrants and certainly talked a great deal with the people who have been instrumental in trying to help them, you know, get resettled. So it was quite a long process.
There are so many small towns all over the United States and obviously in Maine, but also in Iowa, that have been transformed by these new populations coming
That's
in.
And, right.
and not just from Somalia, but it is so interesting to explore the changes that take place, because in many of these small towns, honestly, it has saved the town to have a new population.
Yes.
But there are a lot of tensions that can be created there
of
as well.
Course. Of course, it's pretty fascinating to me, because it's a very real change that's happening in this country, and these towns definitely need new populations, and it's just going to take some time, as things do, to get this sort of sorted out of how we all live together. In many ways, it's not new, but it feels very new because of all the attendant differences that occur. You know, and all these things take time to get incorporated into a population that's simply not used to that. Maine, of the 50 states, is the whitest state, and it's the oldest state demographically. So, you know, it's been in many ways a challenge, and in many ways one that they've risen to quite remarkably. But it is a situation. There's no doubt about it.
So much of what you write about Shirley Falls, Maine, resonates with me as an Iowan when I'm thinking about small towns in Iowa. There is a major difference, though, as well. And it is, when you write about the people who are left behind in Shirley Falls, Maine, there seems to be a resentment of the people who have left. In Iowa, a lot of people leave small towns, and I almost sense that there's a sense of resignation, because it's expected at this point that the young people will go. But do you feel that in Maine there is this resentment of the people who leave?
I think that there is still a lingering resentment, and yet one has to leave. I mean, the way, you know, these towns are in deep trouble and have been for 30 years at least, as all these textile mills have closed and all that sort of thing. There's very little opportunity right now in Maine. It is not an easy place to be young and start a business or to find employment that you are going to continue with. And so I think that they have to leave. But there is this deep sense of territorial aspect to Mainers who have lived there for a few generations. And I certainly come from many, many generations on both sides. So those Mainers that consider themselves the real Mainers, which, like I said, has to carry with it a few generations, there's still a little bit of a sense of like, oh, you know, maybe you think you're a big shot because you've gone and, you know, lived in the city or something. I mean, it's not spoken.
But have you felt that? Because you're one of those. You left.
I've certainly felt that, yeah. But I also know that more and more people are understanding that their kids have to leave.
When Susan, one of the Burgess kids, later in the novel, she goes to New York City to stay with one of her brothers and to visit. And she's been through a great deal. they really all have at that point. But she's so overwhelmed by the city. And she has this moment where she thinks to herself, maybe this is what the Somalis feel like when they come to the United States.
That's right. Well, these are my imaginative powers at work. So I certainly know what it feels like to come from a small town and go to New York City and have the first impression of being overwhelmed by it. I have obviously not lived in Somalia and come from there, but I have been in foreign countries, and the sense of foreignness that makes you feel so confused and just frightened, you know, the smallest detail. I mean, Abdi Karim tries to buy a box in a post office, and he can't do it. He doesn't understand. So just small everyday details of ordinary life are kind of denied you, or at least cause a tremendous amount of stress. And I think that what I was going for there was, you know, Susan has not been particularly open-hearted toward the Somalis in her town. And yet what I wanted was to capture the fact that she was capable of, as I think we're all capable of if we give ourselves a chance, of at least trying to understand a different point of view. And so she's, you know, wrenched out of her town into New York, and she's supposed to be happy. She's there with, you know, visiting. She's supposed to be pleased with the hospitality. And yet she's horrified by everything and how frightening it is. And so that seemed to me like, okay, let's give Susan a chance to maybe open her mind a little bit and wonder. You know, she can't be conclusive about this, but I just wanted to see Susan have a chance to get a little bigger, and I think she does.
In past interviews, you mentioned teaching students and one of the students asking you why all of your work is so depressing. And there are some very depressing things that go on in this book. And Olive Kittredge, obviously, the work that you won the Pulitzer Prize for, there was a lot of depressing stuff in there as well. But there is also sort of a buoyancy about this book. And I love the sibling interactions. They do ring so true to anybody who has siblings, and the way that they regress into their childhood when they're together in their old hometown. Is that from personal experience as well?
I have an older brother, and I think that we do regress when we're together. But I'm also I've watched other siblings, you know, in my in-laws. You just get a chance as you get older to watch older siblings. And it's really, really interesting because it seems that we never do quite lose, as much as we want to be adults with each other, we never quite lose that very unique relationship that we don't really have with anybody else, that goes back to sharing and understanding that we're the only people who really knew what those dishes looked like. We're the only people who really knew what those towels smelled like when they came out of that laundry. You know, I mean, the tiniest details are, you know, we share. And in a way that goes back so far, it's not going to happen with anybody else. It's just not. And yet everybody in a family has a different family. You know, I have a very good friend, and there's three sisters, and they all joke about how they had different mothers. I mean, they didn't. They had the same woman as a mother, but you know, they all had different relationships to her. So they're sisters, but they all feel that they have a different relationship to their own childhood. So it's just a minefield of fascinating stuff as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Well, Elizabeth Stroud, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Novelist Elizabeth Stroud, her latest book is The Burgess Boys. She'll be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.